This art will be continuing my discussions with Hank Loeffler. The day is May 30th, 2007, and as has been the case in the past, we're in Hank's office in the education building and continuing our discussion. So we'll pick up looking at some of the issues you feel continue to be important within the context of your service at the Chancellor's office.
Well, one of the things that we might talk about that I think would be useful was the multi-year planning and execution of the university's sesquicentennial on the occasion of its 150th anniversary. And the date that we used to celebrate was when the first student came to campus in 1848, so that we could celebrate the sesquicentennial in 1998, because we already missed the opportunity to celebrate the sesquicentennial of when the university was chartered by the legislature, or when it was first opened, or any of those sorts of things. Yeah. And so we fumbled around, and since really there weren't that many students to begin with anyway, I suppose it didn't really matter. But we were looking for, and we knew we wanted to celebrate the 150th anniversary. The state was celebrating its sesquicentennial, and it seemed appropriate that the university would celebrate as well. And so there was this period where the university and the state sesquicentennial people were talking back and forth, though the university's celebration of its sesquicentennial turned out to be much more elaborate than that of the state of Wisconsin, actually, when all was said and done. And it was an opportunity for the university to have a series of events across the state, which was one of the plans that the university relations group that I was chairing and working with came up with. It was also a period of time when we had developed the Alumni Association, the On the Road program, where we were taking speakers from the Madison campus across the state to service clubs and to other speaking opportunities in small towns and large cities across the state to talk about either the history of the university or about the specific things that the faculty member might know a lot about that would be of interest in a particular area. So we had scientists going out, and we had Bucky Badger going out, and we did programs in the public schools, and we sent out the band, and there was a variety of different popular figures leaving the campus and going. As is still the practice, there was an annual luncheon at the University Club where campus communications office would distribute a press packet, and when we would discuss what were the basic issues that were confronting the university so that you could put some basic messages into these nice talks that were being given across the state. The admissions office, the admissions director was there to answer questions. Already at that time people were becoming concerned that we were becoming too selective, and so we had the admissions director there.
This is an internal briefing.
Yes.
And you started it for the purpose of making sure that people who had contact with the public would be up to date on what issues people would consider important.
Yes, and then they would, no matter what you were talking about, somebody would raise their hand and talk about the latest campus issue or whatever it was that was of particular interest. And so it was at least a good opportunity for these speakers to have some understanding about what those issues were. And then there were also people like the chancellor or the provost or deans of colleges who were going out around the state who were more adroit at delivering institutional messages. And so they would attend this briefing as well, and we would have answers to the commonly asked questions, and we would have what is the Madison Initiative or the latest budget proposal that we had downtown, and why is it important to us? What's new on the campus, and a variety of other.
This still goes on, is that correct?
It still does go on, yes. And I think the number of people who are delivering these talks and the intensity with which the program is being furthered probably has diminished. But we did at that time hire someone as a part-time and ultimately a full-time employee in the Chancellor's office with the job of directing campus speakers to various parts of the state and to respond to service club invitations and so forth. And it turned out to be quite a successful program. And because there are lots of opportunities, clubs don't always have speakers coming from Madison or elsewhere to come and deliver these talks. So they were very popular. At the same time, we partnered with Milwaukee Art Museum and a variety of other buildings and venues around the state to do a series of programs that might highlight the arts that might last for 2 or 3 days in those locations. So it was a pretty complicated mixture of programs with the university, sort of what we were trying to do. And actually, when the deans and the chancellor and the provost did these talks, they would go to newspaper boards and they would always sit down with the local editors of the local newspapers and allow reporters to interview them about whatever they wanted to, and then meet with the editorial board. Sometimes the chancellor would get on the state plane and we would do multiple stops across the state. We would whistle stop, because with the state plane you could go up and down and you could do at least 3 meals and probably one more stop along the way and get back late at night.
Does the Alumni Association still do this?
Yes, the Alumni Association still does it. What we arranged for the funding of the sesquicentennial, which ultimately involved a very large, we used the Cole Center, musical performance with all highlighting all of the programs of the School of Music, including the band. There was a huge concert that filled the place, and we had a variety of other arts programs in other cities as well. And I think the sesquicentennial programs ultimately had a very significant budget, because we were also doing targeted mailings to alumni and to others that were describing the university at the crossroads and the Madison Initiative and the other thing. It was sort of a marketing opportunity to pile all of that together.
But are the local alumni clubs having what we used to call Founders Day dinners, and then often there would be a speaker from the campus at those events?
Well, we had both corporate lunches and we had Founders Day's talks, yes. And we would also be honoring, on the occasion of the sesquicentennial, we would be honoring local legislators by giving them plaques from the university, presumed for their support in previous budgets. And so we were, there were always these mixed reasons why you were going into a community. And all of the schools and colleges, the university relations team ultimately became just focused on the sesquicentennial, because all of the colleges were sending speakers into an area. We were trying to do sort of saturation programming, so we would have somebody from education who might be doing a public school talk, and somebody might be doing a corporate talk, somebody might be doing a political luncheon, and there were just all of these activities were going on at once. And ultimately they were financed by the annual university relations grant that we got from the UW Foundation, which made it possible for us to encourage schools and colleges to participate in these activities by paying the expenses of some of the speakers, by offering them reimbursement for some of their expenses if they were doing special mailings, or we would be re-granting money from the foundation directly to the Alumni Association to pay for the politically overt portions of this. The Alumni Association would use their own funds for things that state money couldn't be used for, and so forth and so on. So it was a complicated financing package that involved, it didn't involve state money particularly at all, really. It was mostly undesignated gifts and then money from the WAA that made it possible.
You also had a staff member who was assigned full-time duties to coordinate all these activities.
We had Peyton Smith, who's now doing the Wisconsin idea for the provost's office, and certainly this was the Wisconsin idea writ large during the sesquicentennial. It was our attempt to show the impact of the university on the state. So Peyton did the sesquicentennial and ultimately had a staff of two or three graduate students as well as Peyton, and worked full-time on all of these events and the big events in Madison. And at the same time, the Alumni Association had a full-time staff person. Jeff Wendorf was working with someone at the WAA who was putting on the road programs around the state. And that became very time-consuming. And of course, Paula Bonner was involved with these activities as well. So it was a complicated opportunity to celebrate what the university was all about. But it was also a very political movement, because what we were really doing was trying to build legislative support. Thank our friends in the legislature for their past support.
Both of them?
Both. Well, it's hard to imagine as we sit here in 2007. We went through a period of time where the best you could hope for from the legislature was silence with regard to education spending. But at this point in time, people were supportive of the university. There was a bipartisan sort of suburban Republican Democratic legislative support for the university. We tied this all in with the sporting activities. I mean, the University of Wisconsin football team does very well in this period. We go to bowl games, starting with the, at least in my experience, in 1995 with the Hall of Fame Bowl. But other people started sooner than that with 94 Rose Bowl, but I started 95, and we had the opportunity. I didn't always personally attend, except the big ones with the big events like Rose Bowl 99 and Rose Bowl 2000, which we can talk about in a bit. Those are always interesting stories. But the sporting activities were also very big at this time, and the football team was large. And we would go off to these bowl games, and we would have several dozen legislators going with us. I don't mean that we were taking them to the games. They were paying their own way, but certainly they were getting better than average seats and invitations to more than receptions than they could possibly attend. And that was the same profile for the sesquicentennial, and it was an opportunity, I think, that most of us at that time had an enormous sense of pride, because the university's budget was increasing, at least in an incremental basis, if not in real dollar terms, which it never did during the 90s. But at least we saw some additions.
There were, as I remember, a couple of byproducts of this in the form of informational pieces and so forth. Did you do much of that, other than, I remember there was a highlight of 150 years and little bullets about this and that over the years?
Of course there was an ice cream flavor. Right. There was, which I was trying to remember the name of earlier today, and I'm sorry I can't remember. All I can think of is Blueberry after Barry Alvarez, you know, all these, or Berry Berry or whatever.
Well, when Donna first came, we had one called Donna's Delight. Donna Shalala.
Yes, I do remember going over to Babcock with David Ward, and sitting down in one of those booths with Bucky Badger and a variety of other notables to sample the various sesquicentennial flavors.
Oh yeah, that's right.
It was kind of a bland flavor, as I recall. It had sort of strawberries.
The fans picked it, right? Or, I mean, the consumers picked the one they liked the best.
We did have a contest, yes.
Yeah.
And samples were available at various Babcock display areas around campus.
Right.
People voted, and it was the best of democracy at work. But it was a lot of opportunities for, again, targeted mailings and the production of what at the time were serious annual reports, where the university was saying, okay, we set out to improve undergraduate education, and here's what we've done, and we set out to do this, and here's what we've done. And so that there was this sense here's what we promised you folks, and here's what we delivered, and we've been here 150 years, and you should be proud, and here's our proud tradition. And it was a series of, I think, affirming messages that actually carried us right through to the what became the budget crisis of 2001 with the structural deficit and the first of the enormous budget reductions of the university. But at least as David Ward and I walked out the door at slightly different times in 2001, we walked out the door at exactly the right moment, because all of a sudden the truck pulled up out back and took away all the money that we had so carefully built up over the previous 5 years. So it was...
But at the same time, there then were these ideas in place, not necessarily funded, but I mean, you sort of changed the dialogue, because a lot of the things that you were supporting this way have since been folded into the regular program of the university. Is that reasonable?
I think it's safe to say that certainly the emphasis on interdisciplinary research and funding, the enormous importance of gifts, particularly to build things, because this was also a period of time when, just when you think the campus couldn't build another building, we put another one in, and that's continued right to the present. So it's in a sense it's investment in the infrastructure and the space to expand entrepreneurial activities, if not improving undergraduate instructional space. I mean, basically that's where the emphasis has been in the last 20 years, has been more science buildings, more things that make money, biotech, genetics, all of those kinds of investments, and not a new art building and not a new performing arts building for music. And so we have yet to see the arts and humanities flourish in the same way that some of the science is now flourishing, because of the investment in staff and in grants and in buildings ultimately. But the SESCWI was the high watermark for what was it was basically a celebration of our successful relationship with the state of Wisconsin, with the governor, who learned to love to come to all of these events, Tommy Thompson. From the opening of the Cole Center, where he suddenly announced that afternoon that he was authorizing in his own budget adjustment bill 7 new faculty positions in the area of biotechnology, so that he came with good news to the opening of the Cole Center, and it wasn't just Senator Cole who was bringing the good news. There was a period of time then when the Republican governor in effect got the message with regard to the investments that we were making in the campus, because they were good for the state's economy. And this was a message that the state legislature got, and the governor began to support new buildings and support additions to the Madison Initiative. Ultimately, he supported so that you wound up with the state in partnership with the university, a partnership which was possible until they suddenly realized that the state was bankrupt, as most states did when the clock ticked on through the year 2000 and into 2001. It became painfully apparent that the revenue projections that the legislators had counted on to balance the books were way off, and we started down the road toward, you know, a band-aid approach then with the tobacco settlement, so you could pick up the $2 billion that we were short from the tobacco settlement, and that worked for one biennium, but you still had a structural deficit and you'd already spent the tobacco settlement. And so then things really got worse, because the revenue continued to be below the estimates.
I think that still exists to a great degree.
Yeah. I mean, I think clearly now, I think with after the 4 years of Jim Doyle and both parties outdoing themselves to say that they were the party of fiscal restraint, though both parties shopping around looking for pots of money in the state budget somewhere, whether it's the road trust or whether it's a health trust, you know, so that's...
Is this accompanied by shrinking of federal dollars that are available on the broad sense?
No, strange.
State program?
Strangely, what was happening at the same time, which I think in many ways saved the university from greater pain, was that there was at least during the same period of time, a continued investment in basic science research, which began to fade away with the second term, where I'm talking now about George Bush, the second presidential term of George Bush, but which at least was the one thing that both parties could agree on for higher education. And the Republican conservative agenda had turned to No Child Left Behind and was focusing on K-12 for regulation, and essentially had essentially gave higher education a pass for 4 years while changing the Department of Education funding substantially to more conservative research or trial-based research, as they would put it, blind whatever they are research, which basically means no research into the basic causes of why kids don't learn. But during that same time, for example, federal aid programs to students, while the Pell Grant didn't increase, it continued more or less unabated, and so you had this sort of steady to and increasing funding for the National Science Foundation, National Institute of Health. So that was...
So those are dollars we didn't necessarily have to scramble for.
No, and the reason federal funding right now is the largest source of funding on this campus by far in percentage terms was that it continued to stay constant or increase.
Yeah.
And we were extremely, proved extremely adroit in getting those grants.
Yes.
In these competitions, and so it was a period of time where, in some senses, our capacity to build new buildings to house biotechnology research and biochem research and those kinds of genetics, I mean, we just fell behind. And in the medical areas, the hospital has been under continuous construction seemingly forever. I'm sure eventually it'll just roll right over Shorewood Hills and,
yeah,
you know, that would just have an entire... Those mindless corridors that you can never figure out where you are just go on forever. But all of that kind of research money continued. So the campus, to the extent that it is able to use 150 federal overhead dollars to provide maintenance for laboratories and lots of other things that might be a valid expense that we can use 150 money for. I think some of that money was able to be used to help cushion the enormous impact of the decline in state support to the university. And of course, tuition took off like a shot, but was leaving from such a low number to begin with, that while in percentage terms it increased enormously over the period, it was still, I mean, Wisconsin, as we speak today, has the lowest tuition in the Big Ten. And it still is, if you tell people on the East Coast that you can come here for a whole year for $7,000 of tuition, people just burst into hysterical laughter on the East Coast because the state schools there are $24,000 a year or something.
Yeah, you're
like
talking about state
I'm talking
resident
about,
tuition.
Yes, state resident tuition.
Yeah.
And out-of-state tuition, of course, eventually the legislators downtown priced it out of existence,
yeah,
practically, because they went too high with trying to make money on the backs of out-of-state students.
Yeah.
But you could already begin to see as we went through the period of time, say from 95 to 2000 or 2001, you could already see the enormous growth in the university revenues that were non-tuition revenues, non-state revenues, those other sources, gifts and grants, entrepreneurial activities, research, those three sources during this period of time outstripped tuition and state support, basically, so that now state support is number five on the list after tuition, and behind gifts and grants, and behind federal grants and research projects, and behind entrepreneurial activities.
But there still are the day-to-day costs to maintain the infrastructure now. Where does that come from? I mean, one of the arguments is you build all these new buildings, but you don't, establish any funds to keep them clean?
Well, the immediate funds that you establish are that they house research projects that generate 150 federal research dollars back to the campus at the overhead rate of, depending on how it's negotiated, something in the 30s to low 40s, depending on the period of time that we're talking about. So that is designed to be, in some ways, maintenance costs, and in some ways, library expenses and other basic, because that's the overhead that you have to make
that's
things work.
A decision that's made in the chancellor's office when you look at all of these.
Well, the allocation, components? The allocation of the one, the establishment of the 150 money and how it is negotiated with the federal government is both an art and a science, I guess, because it occurs every year, and the federal government negotiates overhead rates with universities. And it's clearly an important part of the grant for the institution, because it is the one way that we get seed money to start new research projects, that we can keep laboratories up to date, that we can maintain all of this, basically this enormous research structure on behalf of the federal government. And the reason, of course, we're doing that is that if America has any hope of remaining a world power, it's going to have to be a place where basic knowledge creation takes place. And if we don't make investments in the laboratories and in the sciences that make those kinds of discoveries that allow us to be stem cell central or whatever it is, then we're not going to survive as a country, because the labor costs and other things for basic manufacturing, I mean, that's all moved away. So that as the world becomes more specialized and various countries become more specialized, the future of our country, and certainly of the state of Wisconsin, has a great deal to do with this kind of research. You could already see in the chancellor's office then the revenue streams changing over time, and you could also see some of the basic political structure of the state changing, because in the period of time from 95 to say 2005, while Wisconsin manufacturers and commerce don't apparently understand this, the state's economy was in the process of bifurcating with the manufacturing interests that were traditionally the state's economy and what WMC represented in the legislature, Harley Davidson and paper companies in the Fox Valley and basic manufacturing in Milwaukee and so forth. So much of that basic manufacturing, of course, has now left the state and gone offshore or elsewhere. And you began to see during this period of time the enormous explosion of university spin-off businesses at our own research park, where we've now got 4,000 or 5,000 jobs, and then there's the next research park, and then there's the next research park, and you go to Fitchburg, and you suddenly realize that you've got all of these informatics, and you go out to Middleton, and you're looking at all of these science experiments underway, and agribusiness, and all. What you're developing in the central part of the state with the University of Wisconsin is a knowledge-based economy, which is developing lots of jobs that are high-paying jobs, and this part of the state is, if you will, prospering. It's growing at a high rate of speed. People are buying houses. We have more Thai restaurants to choose from, and I think what the state hasn't come to terms with yet is what you do with Milwaukee and Racine and Kenosha, and that economy is changing, and there is a So then there is a bit of a shift in the legislature, where the question of making investments versus trying to figure out tax credits for manufacturing jobs and things like that become a more heated issue, because you don't know, the state needs to make investments perhaps in both areas, but the politics of it changed, and so what used to be a very broad support for the university begins to dwindle as WMC continues to want lower taxes as the savior of the Wisconsin economy, and other people are prepared to make investments in biotechnology, which runs counter to the low tax mantra of WMC, and so you wind up with suburban Republicans pinched, if you will, and being asked by Republican supporters these days to support lower taxes when they have a sense in which supporting parents to send kids to college and making investments in universities is probably something that they want to support, but they're in a sort of a hard spot right now in terms of the politics of the state. So you wind up with fewer Republican supporters of the university, and you wind up with social conservative legislators wanting low taxes and running conservative candidates in state senate districts against Republican incumbents who were friends of the university and beating them. And pretty soon then you've got this sort of polarized situation which we now find in 2007. Perhaps it's getting better because the last election was a little better. But anyway, you could see those things coming.
It seems that related to what you've been talking about is one of the hues and cries of the moment is the fact that we have a brain drain in the state, and all of our graduates of the university are leaving the state, and we need them here. How do we deal with that sort of contradiction?
Well, there's two ways to look at the brain drain. One is to say it's temporary, and that a lot of people who leave the state come back to the state. We see this all the time when our faculty get a better offer and they go someplace else and they say, "Eh, I don't like Los Angeles," and they come back.
Yeah.
But there's no question but what there's a chicken and egg problem. Do high technology based businesses settle in Wisconsin? Does Epic move to Fitchburg because there is a ready supply of bachelor's degree, well-trained people with master's degrees, whatever the particular, do they come here and settle here because we already have them? Or do we need to be producing graduates to stock businesses later on? In other words, we have the whole question is, with talented undergraduates who get bachelor's degrees here, a certain percentage of them are going to go away anywhere because they came from someplace else to begin with, and they're going to go back there, and they'll be our loyal alums, and they may make us the gifts down the road that make the difference, because a greater percentage of our budget comes from alumni gifts now than it does from the state. So that's one way of looking at it. There's no question but what we have to continue to produce bachelor's degrees, because it seems that most of the businesses that are expanding come here because they expect to find an intelligent workforce. But more importantly, do big businesses really move to Wisconsin because, damn it, they don't have to pay taxes, or do they come here because this is an interesting place to live? And it seems to me that the WMC approach to lower taxes as being the only important thing misses the fact that most people who work at a university or for a corporation are interested in more than just the salary and cheap taxes. They want to have good schools where their kids can go, where there aren't enormous social problems because there are programs that teach people how to live with one another, and there's wonderful natural resources, and they like to camp outside, and the fine arts are, this is the Florida approach here, where the guy says, oh, everybody wants to live in a place where there's interesting culture. I think all of that is really very true, and I think that you find it now, I think we have reached a critical mass in the Madison area and in southern Wisconsin generally, very broadly across the, perhaps from La Crosse, and across the southern part of the state. This is an interesting place to live.
One of the comments that comes up in regard to young people has to do with the fact that most of what you've talked about is people with families, and young people want to go where there's a lot of action.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have any real metropolitan areas where that takes place. Milwaukee is a shadow of its former self, and it's not a place where young people would want to go. Madison might offer a little more, but still, there aren't any of those type of communities around, so to go to Chicago or Minneapolis, other places that are larger.
Yeah, they go away to the big city, and I don't think the lights of the big city are going to be attracting any fewer people on into the future.
No, but that provides fodder for the argument that we've got the brain drain and those kinds
of things. Well, actually, I see this the other way around, because I see, at least among the graduate students who worked here, in the School of Education that I've worked with over time, there's a significant percentage of them who have a spouse who's got an interesting job here at the university or whatever, and a lot of people struggle to stay in Madison because they love the place, they love the quality of life here, they love the university community, they love the youth of the place, because while we don't necessarily have a lot of things for 20-somethings to do, boy, there's an awful lot of people here between the ages of 25 and 35, so you have a critical mass of bars and nightclubs, and you can... I think there's another way of looking at it, and that is the fact that there are so many people who struggle to stay, and so many people that I work with at the university who said, well, I came here for graduate school and then I stayed on, which is certainly my story, and a lot of other people's stories, because we came at a time when there was an expanding university and we could latch onto it pretty easily, and so we did. And I think a lot of people, like many of our own current graduates with PhDs, go away, of course, because you can't be hired by your own department, and even if you could, it's probably not a good career move, because people will always think of you as a graduate student even if you're 50, if you didn't go away someplace and then come back. And if we hire somebody from outside, that person obviously has been validated by some other place, and so they're a hotter commodity when they come back than if they just stayed. So that's another reason why sometimes people leave the state and then come back again for a job, is that you don't want to be thought of as just Art who stayed on here and, you know, is still kind of a graduate student even though he finally finished his degree, as opposed to Art who went off to the University of Minnesota for a couple of years and then came back. Then you're certified, you see, to return as a right. full-grown adult. And so, I don't know, the brain drain question is an interesting one. And usually, critics who advance that theory would have us try to figure out a way to penalize people who took advantage of our low tuition and then left the state by making them pay a penalty of some sort, or on the other hand, many other states give the people the opportunity to stay in the state if they work in certain occupations and have their loans forgiven or whatever. So you've got, Wisconsin really hasn't spent a whole lot of time thinking about this. I think there's a basic problem with the state, and that is that we have not had the kind of dialogue that other states have had with regard to the relationship between our two-year technical college system, our two-year campuses, and the four-year institutions. And what are we really doing with all of these bachelor's degrees and other degrees? Do we have the right mixture of programs for the residents of the state?
Well, we also, using your example of the WMC, have let others dictate what it is we're going to talk about, as opposed to a much larger look at the key questions that you're discussing. So anybody with a certain cachet can come forward and say, well, here's the way it is, here's what we're concerned about, and presumably then represent the feelings of many when, as you have articulated, it's a very narrow part of the actual reality.
I think we don't have the right people at the table anymore to talk about higher education. I think there was a time when the regents and the higher ed committees of the Senate and the State Assembly had some very thoughtful dialogues about the future of higher education in the state. And I think as sort of mind-numbing calls for lower taxes have replaced serious debates about making an investment in the future of the state. And the state, in the meantime, the university's budget completely changes around so that now the state provides 10% of our budget for programming or whatever it is, and maybe another 5% for buildings. But the state legislature does all of our budget. the people who give us gifts and the businesses who expect technological research and the future, you know, invest that kind of investment by the universities are not necessarily on the Board of Regents, and they're not in the legislature, and certainly they wouldn't be at the salaries that the legislators make, which are puny. So you wind up then with a professional legislature which is better at being know-nothings than having serious discussions. And so
I think that's a key point.
It's
is that quality of our public representatives has declined over the last generation, shall we say.
Yeah, and things became much more partisan, and then all of a sudden the parties in Wisconsin don't stand for anything anymore. There is no Democratic Party of Wisconsin or Republican Party. There are just individual legislators running wildly for re-election and running, you know, scared most of the time. And so you don't wind up with any serious debate about, we have some wonderful technical college programs at MATC here in Madison and other technical colleges across the state. They are doing an enormous amount to train entry-level and beyond workers for many different occupations. They train many of our own students who transfer credits here. They have a medley of missions. We also have lots of majors that tie in with various businesses across the state. Our School of Engineering ties in enormously with all engineering companies. Mm-hmm. Our medical enterprise ties in with the hospitals of the state, and we train teachers for the state, and we train nurses for the state, and all of these other things, which are basic investments in the state, its economy, its social life, its educational systems. And somehow or other, the quid pro quo here of what are we making this investment for and what is the best investment for Wisconsin has been forgotten. We just have not had that debate in the last two decades. And it's a real shame, because Wisconsin used to be an education state where people would really sit down and say, all right, we really expect the University of Wisconsin-Madison to have challenging ideas on its campus. We really expect that from time to time you will have idiots on your campus. But as our alumni constantly tell us, the time that they spent here was enlivened by the fact that there were people saying outrageous things, which other people found to be offensive, and they really learned how to engage in an exchange of ideas about complicated issues.
Do you feel the media have a responsibility in this area?
Well, the media, we used to have great education reporters that would stay a long time and look at the newspapers, and they were paid decent salaries, and they could reflect on these kinds of issues. And now they spend most of their time on the rewrite desk, and people don't read long newspaper articles anymore, and the newspapers don't present them except when they're going for the annual prize in something or other, and then they have a series which is thoughtful. But the number of column inches devoted to higher education, I know, because I've got boxes of all of the clippings for all of the issues that I was involved with in the chancellor's office, and the column inches about the campus have plummeted, and the real debate over and debates over the role of the university with the liberal arts as distinct from just the sciences or those kinds of issues have all just vanished. Mm-hmm. And newspapers now report, to the extent that they report anything about higher education, it's high salaries of somebody or other making the university look privileged and shocking the public, or it's about scandals, and heaven knows we had scandals when I was in the chancellor's office, but we also had the opportunity for the chancellor to go and sit down, as he did several times a year, with the local editorial boards of the newspapers, and actually sit there for 3 hours and have a conversation with the editors about what the challenges were, and a real sense from that you had engaged. It wasn't exactly a Chautauqua, didn't go on for days, but you had the opportunity then and then you would see these people socially. They'd come to a football brunch, and you know, Dave Zweifel would yuck it up in the backyard, and people would have these conversations, and he'd say, well, what about this idiot? And you'd say, he's an idiot, we can't fire him, because if we fired him, his appeal process would be longer than his retirement date, so we're saving you money. And they go, oh, okay, well, that kind of makes sense, but wouldn't it be nice? I'd feel better if you fired him, even if it did cost money. And then we'd say, well, look, if we fired him and it cost more money, you'd write a story about that. And if we don't fire him, you'd write a story about that. Which story should we have, the cheap story or the expensive story? So we pick the cheap story, you know. And then they go, ho, 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 and, you know, but we would, you know, you'd have a certain level of candor. And I think what's missing in today's contemporary world, where newspapers are trying to compete, perhaps unsuccessfully, with television and with other sources of news and entertainment, I think what's been lost, except for public television, has essentially been sort of the substitution of a slick and quick profile or answer or issue, and the more thoughtful, engaged kinds of dialogues that used to last a long time have now gone by the wayside entirely. And I think the average legislator now feels that they don't understand higher education, or worse, they think they do understand higher education, but it's only a little sliver of the enterprise. And 25 years ago, for example, when Dick Flintrop was the chair of the Assembly Education Committee, we'd bring him here to the School of Education with members of his committee, and he'd come down for lunch four or five times a year, and we'd sit downstairs in room 154, and he'd say, okay, tell me about this individually guided instruction, and we'd talk about that. He'd say, well, now, what about this, that, and the other thing? And, oh, that's interesting. And
now you're saying, on the basis of your
previous experience in education, we used to have regular meetings with the Assembly.
You're saying now there's nobody up there.
Nobody wants to come.
Or that you'd want to invite, necessarily.
We invite them. Yeah. And to their credit, some have come down. I think we've always had more thoughtful discussions about legislative issues with the staffs of the legislature, and with the Legislative Reference Bureau and so forth. But in a situation when the extremely bipolar, sort of conservative, liberal standoff in the legislature and the concern for lower taxes at the expense of common sense, and the difficult situation, I don't mean to trivialize their problems either, because they really bet on the continued soaring of the economy in the 1990s, which didn't carry over, and so the state, every other state in the union practically, except for Alaska with oil revenue or something, Wyoming with gas revenue, I mean, it was a period of time when states had to retrench and universities had to pay the price.
Let me go back just briefly to something you mentioned previously, and that is the type of legislator you're getting seems to be the person whose fundamental interest is getting reelected, because that's their job. And they want to preserve their job. So therefore, they're not prone to open the kind of discussions about what are we all here for that you claim are a thing of the past and really need to be revived in some way or another.
Well, when I came down to do the Higher Education Center and to work with external relations in education after I left John Wiley in the Chancellor's office, I talked to it's very liberating, of course, because you don't represent the Chancellor's office anymore, so you can be much more reckless than you would be if you worked in the Chancellor's office. But my longtime involvement in Eastside Madison politics, I sat down with Mark Pocan and Mark Miller, who was running for the state senate, ultimately elected to the state senate from Monona, and Joe Parisi, who's my assemblyman. They're wonderful Democrats. And I talked to them about the university. I said, gee, you got about 350 university employees living in your district, Joe. What are you going to say about university issues? And he's going to say, well, I'm going to say the university is a great thing, but I'm going to talk about health care. because their focus group said everybody cared more about healthcare than they did about the university, which was doing okay, thank you. So there was a general sense in which when the bottom falls out of the state's economy and they don't have any more money to spend, and Medicare is a sum sufficient, and prisons are a sum sufficient, and you have a K-12 formula that says you have to provide 2/3 of the funding or whatever it is, so you wind up with these three large cash cows just taking, yeah, you know, as a sucking noise, and all the money goes to them. And so it wasn't that they were disrespectful of me because I worked at the university. It was just that protecting elder care and protecting Medicare and, you know, medical payments to the, you know, I mean, those were the issues in these overwhelmingly Democratic districts that people cared about. And of course they would support the university to the extent that anything was left over, but they really had to say that their first concern was basic social services, which were always in jeopardy in the state legislature. So it wasn't that they were incapable of having the dialogue any longer, it was just that nobody wanted to have it, because it would be like eating cake during the French Revolution. I mean, things went so bad in the state that the university just left us alone, turned their back and said, raise tuition as much. Even the conservative Republicans in the main, during this entire period from 2000 on, essentially said, we'll help you out a great deal. We won't say anything when you raise tuition.
Yeah. Well, that is a big help.
So it was a big help. I mean, in the sense that the tuition was very low to begin with for in-state study. So that was considered to be a major legislative victory for John Wiley and the crew, was at least they would stay silent while the regents raised tuition. And so that became then, as it did in many other states, it became the basic fiscal formula was, you folks did very well during the 1990s when we continued to support you, and in effect the state legislature at the time would buy things like they did the Madison Initiative. They would increase your budget to pay for the Madison Initiative because they liked its undergraduate components or whatever it was. And so they would, and I'm saying this in quotes, buy things. They would raise a campus or a systems budget by a certain sum of money which would improve undergraduate education, let's say, or which would enable us to expand the La Follette Center. They would make increases contingent on serving more students, or so you would get this. I remember, and what Catherine Lyle, the system president, talked about at the time when she was system president, was that the legislature would agree to buy something during the 1990s, but at no time during the 1990s did these increases in state support of the Madison campus or of the system increase commensurate with inflation.
Nor would they be fully incorporated in the base budget, is that correct?
Or you would wind up with one-time expenditures, or you would wind up with, and this was a period of some inflation, and in higher education is hit more by inflation because we are enormous consumers of energy products, and we have big campuses.
We have competition for our outstanding faculty and staff.
Yeah. And actually, I think it's the private sector. I mean, if you look at what happened to DeWitt, the enormous computer service on campus, they would constantly bleed all of their best people to the private sector because the programmers and the computer whizzes would go away, and they would leave us with, I don't want to say the second team, but they would leave us with employees that perhaps weren't quite as skilled. So during this period of time, you wound up with, during the 1990s, it wasn't so great, but the increase in federal grants and the increase in gifts and the other sources of revenue, and what was a rapidly growing increased revenue coming into Wharf, and we were also getting a maturing of large gifts from our alumni who had attended the place and had done had made fortunes. In effect, the post-war crowd was still alive and very important, the GI Bill folks and stuff like that. But what we were getting were people in the 50s and 60s in a rapidly growing and maturing post-Sputnik economy making fortunes in their lifetimes.
Yeah.
It's John and Tasha Morgridge, who are, you know, major benefactors of the School of Education and of the campus, graduating from Wauwatosa High School and getting married as childhood sweethearts. And the rest is history, because John Morgridge does very well with Cisco Systems and becomes a billionaire and gives hundreds of millions of dollars to the campus, and it's not, or to campuses, and it's not an utterly unique story. We have a lot of people who are first or second generation extraordinarily wealthy people who make the university the object of their affection. And at the same time that the state is cutting and cutting and cutting its support, every time I open my desk drawer, out falls a what is the percent of the state support of the university, and it's, I've got it going back in time, these little cards, you've seen them, the little wallet cards that people use to talk about this question. And all of a sudden, these private gifts are extraordinarily important to us, because they are providing the margin between a crummy or an average place and a great place. And increasingly, we are relying on gifts. Another $3.5 million came in this morning to the Department of Kinesiology. Gifts that we, now it's getting scary, because these are gifts I worked on. So I know the life story of all of the people and why they did it, and they're doing it because they were here during the heady growth period in the 1960s and 70s of the university, and they loved the place. And they view their success in life as having something substantially to do with this campus. So now suddenly they're giving this money at the same time that the legislature, which should be filled with the same spirit, is turning their backs on us. And again, I think because there's just nothing they can do.
Let's stop there and pick up the next time and see what other relation issues related to these kinds of developments you think are important.
Well, I think the one other thing that I want to say while we're still on this on this topic, if we could, Art, is during the period in the 90s, the campus investments, if you will, were maturing, and we were getting annual income to spend from Wharf and from other places like that. That's earned income, in a sense, patent income, and so forth. And we would get quarterly checks in the chancellor's office from Hilldale Shopping Center. The manager would come in and hand over a check for $600,000 or $1 million or whatever it was quarterly, which was our share of how well they were doing. And of course, we'd say thank you very much, give the money to the foundation. We didn't have a desk drawer here where we kept the money. But it was, and Wharf revenue, and we were the beneficiary of lots of bequests during this period of time, and money would come into the foundation, and we were creating an endowment. We were not spending the income, but eventually, you know, $10 million here and $10 million there, and pretty soon you've got an annual income.
Yeah.
Real Estate Park began to mature as an investment, and now finally is paying off a significant annual sum for all of that investment. And every year we would have what I would regard as, and I think what the campus wisely regarded as, one-time money. And the question would come up, and I think some of the most interesting discussions I ever participated in the chancellor's office was, okay, what do we do with the money? And this was, from my point of view, essentially an income transfer. And when my friends in the social sciences or the arts and the humanities get all excited because they see all the new science buildings going up and they don't see anything for them in this part of the campus, you know, I think that that's a relatively narrow view in some ways, because what was really happening in the chancellor's office was that there was a redistribution going on where parts of the campus were disproportionately generating revenues and they weren't getting to keep them. It was the the most important job, perhaps, that a chancellor or a chancellor and a provost would have in a year was to say, all right, how do we keep the playing field reasonably flat here? How can we pay for some of the other things that the arts and the humanities are not generating huge revenues, biotechnology is? How do we move it around? And that's what we were about during the late 90s, was moving things around, maybe $50 million a year.
Okay, we'll come back next time and pursue this further.
That's a real interesting topic, yeah, because no one's ever talked about that.
Yeah, okay, well, let's pick up there next time.
Sure, we can do that.